I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Take a chance on us. It's another Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham, and this week we're talking about the follow-up to the smash hit Mamma Mia. Mamma Mia, here we go again. Now, just one look across the podcast studio table, and I can hear a bell ring. Opposite me, we've got film writer and one of Park Circus Film's finest people, Alistair Bayman.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
And she's from Film 4, the reviews editor of One Woman with a View, and she's back on this podcast for the second week in a row. Truly a super trooper. It's Steph Watts.
Hello.
So this is Ol Parker's follow-up to Villa de Lloyd's Mamma Mia. I'm surprised it's taken 10 years to get here.
Yeah, very surprised. It feels like The Incredibles in terms of it's taken this long, but it's well worth the hype, I think.
Do you think it's been that they refuse to make one until they know the time is right?
Yeah. Yep.
Maybe.
Who knows? Been honing it for 10 years.
They just had to nail the story first, yeah. Before anyone really
all them
to
complicated it. Plot narratives, mm. all the fathers, you know, it does take Richard Curtis 10 years to write this film. So, yeah.
Well, it is interesting that in the age of franchises being planned out 10 years in advance and people gambling on sequels and prequels before even a first film was released, the fact that the first Mamma Mia came out in 2008, it was on a $50 million budget and it made over 500. The fact that it has actually taken 10 years to end up with a sequel is really surprising. So the plot of the sequel follows mostly young Donna, played by Lily James, Donna being the Meryl Streep character from the first one, and her daughter Sophie in the present day. And in the absence of her mother, Sophie is launching a revamped version of the Greek hotel we saw in the first film. And as she prepares, we cut back to the 70s to see Donna and are told the story of how she fell in love with the island, three different handsome young men, and the greatest love of her life, her daughter. Now, guys, I'm ashamed to admit it. I only saw the first Mamma Mia on Sunday.
Shame.
It hasn't been in my life for very long. I know for Steph, this is an important film for you, taken around on musical tours.
Oh, why? Why did you bring that up? Yeah, perhaps the nerdiest moment of my life. But yeah, I used to play saxophone in my college band. And we went on music tour to Italy and played Mamma Mia on the coach. Everyone took a different role and sang along. It was great. So yeah, it's been a big... I've watched this film so many times.
Pick a number out of thin air.
Oh, I don't know. Probably like between 10 and 20 times.
Wow.
Since it's come out.
Okay.
It's just one of those, like, whenever it's on, you just watch it. Whenever you're like with your friends, you watch it. Mm. Whenever like you're home with your mum and you need something to watch, it's Mamma Mia.
There's almost an Abba-esque quality to those words. Whenever you're home and you're with your mum, you need something to watch. Ali, what about you?
Yeah, I was kind of, as a kid, I always remember my Scottish nana, she'd always play the Abba greatest hits on vinyl. And right. It was like my first interaction with vinyl. So I always had this like level of vintageness to Abba. And then growing up in a family of women, like, going to see the first one was an absolute onslaught. Like, it was just carnage in the house. So, yeah, it's always been there. And I kind of agree with Steph. It feels like one of them films that whenever it's on, you kind of just go with it. It's there. It's, like, obviously similar to this one, not much of a plot, but you're not really there for the plot. You're there for the big numbers and the silly costumes.
Well, let's recap that plot. So the first one mostly follows Meryl Streep's character Donna and Sophie, played by Amanda Seyfried. Sophie invites three men to this island for her wedding, and one of those three men is her father. And that's really it. And then in between, there's ABBA songs. And I was texting Steph when I was watching this for the first time because I didn't fully appreciate how wild it is. It's kind of just your standard musical fare for a bit at the very beginning. It's a bit Disney, kind of three young women dancing around trees, singing Honey, Honey. And that's kind of what I was expecting. And then by about the 10-minute mark, it drops into Money, Money, Money. You've got Meryl on the front of a speedboat. Julie Walters on a quad bike behind her. Helicopter shots. And that's when I realised that I'm into this, if they're willing to go that mad with it. And how did we react then to Here We Go Again? Did it top that madness? Did it live up to that 10 years of expectation?
I don't know. I think what's so great about the first one is all these kind of actors joining in who you wouldn't really think would do something like that. So I mean, like Meryl Streep, Pierce Brosnan, Colin Firth, it's these kind of middle-aged actors dancing around a Greek island. And then in the second one, I think I was kind of looking forward to just seeing more of that. But obviously the prequel plot, so kind of going back in time, you go back to the kind of Disney-esque, like, young actors dancing around, but you do have some amazing kind of set pieces, like, and set musical scenes.
Yeah, I think that's the big difference for me, is that I think the directorial craft in Here We Go Again is, I think, a lot more engaging and a lot more fun. It's taken away any shackles that might be there. I know Phyllo de Lloyd, who directed Mummy, came from a theatre background, and she directed the stage show, and I think it ultimately means, even though the first one is a lot of fun, it is also in a way quite regimented, and some of the camera choices are almost not fully committed to. Like, there's a lot of just spinning around for the sake of movement because we're in a film and we're not on stage, so what can we do differently? Whereas Ol Parker with Here We Go Again feels a bit more in sync with music and sound and editing. It sounds really silly, but when all, like, sound and vision and everything is working together, for me, that right, whatever it might be, it gives me a shiver. But, like, when something is just working so well, and during the Waterloo scene in the new one and during the Dancing Queen sequence, I had that stupid shiver of everything coming together. And I didn't think I'd say that about a Mamma Mia film.
Yeah, it's that motion is emotion, that, like, trite old saying of cinema. But I definitely agree with you. It's got a lot more, you know, cinematic panache, if you want to say. Like, Robert Yeoman, the guy who does Wes Anderson's films, shot this. And you can definitely feel it, because there's a scene where it's Amanda Seyfried and Dominic Cooper. They're, like, having an argument through the power of musicals, and the camera's, like, spinning around this mirror, and I was like, whoa, hold on a minute here. This is like, you know, Mamma Mia 2, Here We Go Again, and using this editing technique. And even in the production design of it, like, you've got obviously the big reunion scene where Stella Skarsgård, Colin Firth come back to the island, and she's just, like, mass helicopter shots. And then also the sheer amount of extras you've got in this film is ridiculous. Like, it's a sequel can always go bigger and better, but I think with the nature of Mamma Mia, how it's just, as we've said, it's just, like, crazy stupid fun, kind of suits this level of one up, like, turning it up to 11, I think.
Very much so. So let's dive into a bit more of Here We Go Again and how it begins. So the first big song is When I Kiss the Teacher, which is not an ABBA song I knew, and the fact that that is your big opening number. Amanda Seyfried does have a little bit beforehand, but I would say this is your proper opener. And I think it's kind of laying its cards out on the table, the film, there, by making its big open a song that you don't know. And I'm curious how you guys were expecting, and then how you reacted to the music in this film, because when I was watching the first one, it got to the end and I thought, that was great, But they've used up every banger. I can think, is it maybe Waterloo is the one that's missing? I couldn't think of anything else. So what on earth are they going to do in the sequel when they've already used everything up? How did you guys react to that?
I think the teacher thing, it's funny with the Mamma Mia stuff, because even though the songs are ABBA, they kind of work in the context of the film, which is strange. And obviously it's like played up as this Oxford graduation, which is very much... like, yeah, you can tell the production design is all there, but, like, yeah, as you say, aesthetically and the way it just comes out with a bang, it's just, it kind of does work in a strange sense, even though you're not as, you know, like...
You can't sing along
yeah,
to
you
it,
can't.
You can't dance
I'm sure there
along,
are some people who can,
yeah.
but overall, it's not that level of just hell for leather going for ABBA-ness.
Yeah.
There's a level of subtle, not subtlety, but... like just more emotion to these new songs, which I feel come into it.
And this is where I think the direction's really important for the film, that if you've got something, a song that everyone knows, say the Winner Takes It All from the first film, which is Meryl standing on a cliff, and it's effectively just film performance. There's not much else going on there. The thing that's driving it is her. I wasn't sold on the scene, but I know a lot of people would say, like, it's raw emotion and you don't need anything else because you've got Meryl. I'm not going to take that. It just looks like they ran out of money. But you go with Kiss the Teacher. This is Lily James playing the young Donna, and Jessica Keenan-Wynn, who is the young Tanya. That's the American Christine Baranski's character. And you've got Alexa Davis as young Rosie, who is the younger Julie Walters character. And they're introduced in this opening song. And I think it's because Ol Parker is really pushing every aspect of the filmmaking process at this point. He's really driving in crazy costumes. Like, there's some camera work that's really impressive. There's a moment where they're graduating school and then they run out of the school and they all get on their bikes and cycle down to the river. And there's a dolly shot that runs down the side of the bike rack just as all of the bikes get taken out, and it's completely choreographed and cut to the music. And it didn't need to be there. You could have just done an aerial shot, show people taking their bikes out. But it's just putting in that extra effort to bring that dynamism and bring the energy up, because you know everyone in the audience isn't quite going to be there for this song just yet. And I think that runs across the whole film, that he's willing to put in that extra effort to really bring them and make them alive, rather than just making film performance pieces.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think because as well you've got this kind of new aspect to it where you're kind of leaving the island and you've got a whole new set of characters. So Lily James instead of Meryl Streep, it needs to draw you in. It needs to do something that the first one didn't. And I think as well because it's not based on the stage show, there's so much more freedom to just do it as a film, not as a kind of adaptation of a show that's already running.
So
he's got a lot, I feel like, a lot more freedom, probably a lot more pressure to actually make it work and make you feel the kind of joy that you get out of the first one from just recognising all the big ABBA songs.
Yeah.
So in this one, you've got kind of new songs, new characters and a new kind of direction, but you've got so much more kind of cinema technique.
That's it. Yeah. It feels like he's actually playing with the form a lot more, which I think does go back to Philip a lot as a theatre director. Primarily, I mean, not that she's made good films, but I think this feels someone who's having a bit more fun with it. I think if you adapted the stage play and then you're making the film, you might be a bit precious with it. This guy's got no real connection to it, and I think is a bit more content to rip it apart. And I think it's a bit more self-aware. In that first one, there was still only 6 years since Brosnan had done Die Another Day. People were still not sure what Brosnan was at that point in time, and it actually made that first one quite awkward, and he kind of got slammed for it. Whereas now, I think everyone's on the side of Brosnan, and you're going into it because he is a bit rubbish and it is a bit like your uncle drunk at a wedding singing, but it's quite nice.
Yeah, no. At the screen I was at last night, obviously there was the kind of maybe purposely, who knows, giving him a more softer song to sing with only a few seconds, really, when you think about the grand scheme of things. But yeah, there was a guy who was like kind of laughing, but the rest, you could kind of feel it. Like, I think throughout that whole film, you are laughing at Mamma Mia, you are laughing at Brosnan, but then strangely, time has been fortuitous to like that on-screen relationship between him and Meryl Streep. Weirdly, Brosnan kind of, he feels comfortable in this film, whereas, as you said, the first one is drunk uncle at a wedding.
Well, that's singing. It. I think in that first one, all the chaps are not quite sure what their role is, how this is going to be reacted to, and they're maybe trying to shackle off some celebrity identities that they might have, or for Skarsgård, maybe take his career into a different direction of being more of a fun guy. Whereas Firth, Skarsgård and Brosnan in this just look like they're happy to be there, which maybe doesn't benefit performances. But in a weird kind of Richard Linklatery way, sometimes it's nice to just watch people have a nice time. And that is this. How do we feel about the young versions of those characters? Because those are, the big introductions in this one. So you've got Jeremy Irvine as young Sam. So Jeremy Irvine, people might know from War Horse. You've got Hugh Skinner as young Harry, who is the young Colin Firth. And now he is Fleabag's kind of posh boyfriend in Fleabag. But he's also Laura Dern's assistant in The Last Jedi. And finally, you've got Josh Dillon as young Bill, who is the Stellan Skarsgård character. What do we think of these chaps? Did they do a good job? If they had to stand in the shadows of great men.
I think the one who played young Colin Firth, young Harry.
Yes. Oh,
Firth Philip. With his little leather jacket that's like a bit too small.
And his T-shirt's a little bit too short for him.
Yeah, kind of broke my heart. Like, he was like the new generation of Richard Curtis, bumbling, nice idiot. Big fan of him. I'm not too sure about the other two. Because there was like so much going on, because you had the old versions and the young versions. There wasn't much screen time for all of them. So I don't think you really got to judge how good each of them were.
Between the two timelines and trying to fit in about 18 songs, your plot's not long here. I think Hugh Skinner is the standout for me. I think he's naturally really funny. He's playing off of a kind of character that he's built in other shows of that kind of Tim Tim, nice but dim. But he handles it really well. And he's got some pipes, yeah?
Mm. Yeah, and he's that Waterloo scene. I think throughout the whole, balancing 18 songs and all this plot and flash forwards, I think that's a moment that stands out looking back at it, just for its like absurdity of actually being in Paris and like using Waterloo legitimately, you know.
I think this is the best scene in the film. I think Waterloo sequence is proper. I tweeted about this afterwards. It's legitimately one of the best scenes of the year. It's so well put together. The audacity of it to just write in that a character happens to be in Paris because you know that you couldn't figure out how to do Waterloo in the first film, but this is some way of doing it. And I think it benefits from not really being tied to much plot. The fact that they don't have to be super emotional about Meryl or the island or who's in love with who, that it is just, it's in a Parisian restaurant, and Hugh Skinner wants to spend the night with Lily James, and that is the battle in front of him. That is his Waterloo. And you spend the next 4 minutes charging through this battle, through this incredible dance scene in this French restaurant. And it's brilliant. You've got sliding across bars, you've got waiters doing backflips, you've got them appearing under dinner trays and looking, it's very 70s. You've got, like, it's absolutely wonderful. I was beaming through that.
I just love as well when the whole surrounding cast just breaks out into song and dance. That's just, you can only do that in, like, in a musical film where it just, like, everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah, I always love looking at the extras whilst the scene's unfolding, just to see their expression of sheer joy and and just the choreography of it all, because, yeah, that Waterloo scene, there is, and don't they use a lady in a wheelchair as well to spin her around, which is really impressive as well. Yeah, there's the as I said, the extras and the choreography is, like, legit on point, which is refreshing in a musical.
Yeah. I think the other standout song for me anyway is Dancing Queen. Yeah. You've raised your fist there, Steph. Raised
Dancing
two.
Queen. Well, they had Dancing Queen in the first one, didn't they? Yeah. And they did the same kind of thing where they all run down to the harbour. But this time it's kind of two, it's like boats coming in, them going down to the harbour. It's just bigger. So joyful.
And
you've got Stellan Skarsgård and Colin Firth doing King of the World Titanic on the front of a super yacht, which is worth the ticket price alone, I think. Before we go, I think we've got time to talk about one more scene, which has to be Fernando, the moment we've all been waiting for. Cher, Andy Garcia together on screen singing. Did we all explode?
Just fantastic.
Yeah. I exploded before that with Andy Garcia just chilling as this, like, suave little kind of Greek guy. I don't know what he is.
Which actually draws me into the strangest thing about the film, which I couldn't believe. Like, the audacity of it, that they basically, in multiple scenes, have an extra dressed as Andy Garcia that's just walking around.
What?
And in one scene, they even go past his face, and he's got the same costume. He's got a beard. He's got the hat. And it's, like, obviously they only had a certain amount of days of Andy Garcia. Yeah. They know that maybe the primary audience of this film doesn't really care. And you just glide past a chap with a beard and the same clothes. They'll think, oh, so that's the hotel manager from the other scenes. It's not. It's just a random extra. And he appears in multiple scenes. Wonderful. Yes, Fernando, played by Andy Garcia. We only learn his name right at the end just for this one joke. And in that moment, he duets with Cher, who I know has been across all the advertising on this. Really, she is in, what, 7 minutes of screen time tops? But she's great.
She arrives at the end to enjoy the party in the kind of sense of the film and the story. Just fantastic. Like, seeing Cher step out of a helicopter on a Greek island to then sing Fernando.
And the writers actually give her some, like, one-liners. Like, they just fire, like, the fireworks at the end. They just fly off Cher's song.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant stuff. I think this film knows its value, and that value is the ability to make fireworks explode in the shape of a heart. And, you know, that's how we all felt at the end of it as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm firmly in the camp of Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and I'll tell you what, I'd probably go again. What about you two?
I was watching it, and before the screen, I heard a girl outside. She was like, oh, I've already got a ticket again for next Tuesday.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, if someone says to me, you've got to go into Mamma Mia right after this, I'm like, yeah, sure thing. You know, I'm so on board with it.
Yeah. But it's not the only film out this week. There's another called A Prayer Before Dawn, which neither Alistair or I have been lucky enough to see. But, Steph, you have.
Have seen it, yeah.
Tell us a bit about that one.
So it's actually based on a true story about a guy called Billy Moore, who is a Brit abroad in Thailand, and ends up getting arrested and sent to a notorious Thai prison. And he's a boxer, so he's kind of in the prison trying to survive and also trying to kind of use boxing to kind of help him get through his time in prison. It's quite a tough watch. It's quite grueling. Kind of the first kind of night in the prison just makes Shawshank Redemption look like a nice weekend away. So definitely be aware of that, but would really recommend seeing it in a cinema. I think I read a lot of the prisoners acting were real prisoners because they shot on location in a Thai prison. And all of them have these amazing prison tattoos, like gang tattoos, just like covering most of their body. And that's kind of in basically every frame. And it's this really gorgeous, like dark green kind of grading on the film. So I think it'd be really good to see on a big screen and really see that kind of the look of it come out.
Yeah, I've heard in that Brawling Cell Block 99, this is a real physical experience that you're locked into it and it's just grueling the whole way.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. It's a really kind of physical film, really like physical performance from Joe Cole.
Yes, at the other Joe Cole. who people may recognise from the nicer episode from the last series of Black Mirror, the one about the Tinder app. He's the chap in that. He's really nice. And I think that's the only thing I've seen of him. And I definitely can't imagine him as a kind of broken boxer in a Thai prison.
He's quite scary. He's quite kind of unhinged. I think he's in Green Room as well.
Right. I can't remember who he is in that. Yeah, but... I think he's just one of the guys.
Yeah. You
know, like who's
the
just
wrong-ins.
In the room. Yeah. No, the right-ins.
Okay.
Who's in the legit Green Room. I think something really bad happens to him in that film.
Maybe that's just what he's into.
Yeah.
Just likes going through it.
Yeah. Great. So that's A Prayer Before Dawn, which is also out in cinemas this week, along with Mamma Mia. If you want to stay at home this weekend and watch something, you can check out Mary Shelley, which is just up on Curzon Home Cinema. That's directed by Haifa Al-Mansour, the director of Wajda. And we recently put up an interview with her on this very podcast. There's also Generation Wealth, which is directed by Lauren Greenfield. It's this late-stage capitalist portrait of image-obsessed, narcissistic and greedy modern America. I can't imagine anyone in that country being like that. But it played at Sundance and now it's available on demand through Curzon Home Cinema as well. And also, if you do want to get out to the cinema and maybe do a double bill, Incredibles 2 is still out there and it's still great. And if you want to listen to our podcast on that, do go back and listen to last week's. We had the producers of the film, Nicole Crindle and John Walker. It was our crossover event with the Cinemile podcast. So Dave from that brilliant show came on and sat in our studio and we talked through The Incredibles 2, another sequel that lives up to the hype. If you've got any thoughts on Mamma Mia, here we go again. We would love to hear them. Email us at podcast@curzon.com and any correspondence we will be reading out on next week's show. In the meantime, do subscribe to the show if you haven't before. You can do so on iTunes and Acast. Leave us a review or a comment. Rate us out of 5. That would be wonderful. And now next week, what will be one of the breakout British films of the year is Apostasy. And Ali, you spoke to the film's director.
I did, Daniel Cocker Teo, not Cocker, whatever I said in the interview for the first few seconds. But yeah, no, it's one to watch. It's going around the UK this week on previews with Daniel there and Molly Wright and a few of the other actresses. So it's definitely one to watch out for this week, but then also when it comes out next Friday.
Great. And I think we'll hopefully have you back in the studio next week and talk through that and your interview with the director there. I'm really looking forward to that one. In the meantime, keep up with us. Follow Alistair at Alistair Bayman on Twitter, Steph @_StephWatts, and me at Jake H. Cunningham. Until next week, though, it's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Steph.
Bye.
It's goodbye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.